All right. The second case on our calendar this morning is the case of Muhammad Adel Awan versus State of Minnesota. We want to welcome you to the Court of Appeals in our virtual oral argument. The appellant will have 15 minutes for oral argument with 5 minutes for rebuttal, and the respondent will have 15 minutes. With that being said, please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments, and the appellant may proceed at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Frederick Goetz. I represent the appellant, Petitioner Muhammad Awan. And may it please the court and counsel, this case presents one issue. Did appellant meet the second prong of the test for ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland versus Washington? In other words, the prejudice prong. And framed in the context of this case, that issue is there a reasonable probability that but for the multiple errors of Awan's trial counsel that the post-conviction court here found, the result of the proceeding would have been different? And the answer to that question, based upon de novo review and considering all of the errors and all of the evidence in toto and collectively, is yes. And I'd like to start out just by clarifying what the prejudice standard is under Strickland. It's well known, but I think in the context of the decision below, it bears repeating. A reasonable probability under Strickland is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. This requires examination of was there a breakdown in the adversarial process that our system depends on to produce just results. And in making that analysis, this court should consider all of the evidence before the jury, as well as all of the errors collectively. And I repeat that standard because looking at the decision below, it's apparent that the post-conviction court, in effect, applied a higher standard. Though the Strickland standard of prejudice was cited, a higher standard was applied. And there's two reasons for that. First, the post-conviction court seems to rely heavily on the decision of this court in Awan's direct appeal and the findings regarding the confrontation clause issue raised in the direct appeal. But that decision is certainly not law of the case. It's not binding nor even persuasive because this case is so different in many respects. First, it's a different issue. The issue before in the direct appeal was whether the district court violated Awan's rights under the Sixth Amendment confrontation clause when it precluded answers to two very, very narrow questions. In answering that question or deciding that issue on the direct appeal, the standard of review was plain error. And that's a much, much higher standard than the substantial or the prejudice prong under Strickland. As this court knows, plain error is error affecting substantial rights and it affected the outcome of the case. So it's a much higher standard. And additionally, and critically, the body of evidence that was before the Court of Appeals in the direct appeal is vastly different from that body of evidence that is now before this court, given the record at the post-conviction court hearing. The only question in the direct appeal were the answers to two narrow questions. First, trial counsel asked the witness, Lamont Gross, had he spoken to his attorney about what kind of deal he would be getting if he testified? And then the other question was, after some colloquy about Gross had an active case pending, well, that's why your lawyer's here, right? So the answers to those questions would have had little, if anything, or would have added little, if anything, to the what it was presented to cross-examine Gross.
Well, as in all of these cases, the issue is what facts are we to consider, correct? I mean,
That's absolutely part of the consideration, Your Honor.
All right. And in this case, we have a victim who basically gave at least two versions of what occurred here. And by virtue of the fact the jury accepted the first version of the victim's rendition of this incident, aren't we to accept that version? I mean, because that version was consistent with the finding of guilt by the jury.
It really wasn't, Your Honor. And if I can expand on that. So yes, the victim here is Ganamo. And if the court's referencing his earlier statements about identification, that what he told the law enforcement officers about who it was who shot him is different than surveillance evidence that showed what Alwan looked like that night in two respects. First, Ganamo described the person who shot him as somebody who had a hairstyle that was an afro, very distinctive. Surveillance evidence showed Alwan as having a different hairstyle. Half of it was braided. Half of his hairstyle was in braids.
Can I ask counsel before you leave that, can you just be specific? What exactly, because I saw two things about relative to the hair description, I think in the first description. Was it afro? Was that the word used? Afro-ish? I saw that word. What exactly was said in the victim's first description?
Ganamo described his shooter as having an afro hairstyle and also wearing a stocking cap.
Okay, so the word afro hairstyle, that literally are the words? Okay.
Correct. Whereas the surveillance video and the descriptions of it in the record show Alwan as having half of his hair in braids and no stocking cap. So Judge Hooten, to back to your question, the evidence never really pinpointed or certainly identified Alwan as the shooter. Then if we go to the next stage of the—
I'm just looking here at Detective Roberson's testimony regarding the victim's first statement. It was that the victim identified the shooter as a light-skinned Somali male, about 5'10" tall, with his hair in an afro-ish style, and something strange about his tooth, such as a chip. That's a pretty specific description. I mean, and as it turns out, the appellant here has a chip in his tooth, right? I mean,
there's absolutely consistencies, Your Honor. You're absolutely right. But I think the question is that enough to pinpoint to the exclusion of everyone else who might have been there? Remember, this was a party attended primarily by Somali and people from that region of Africa, East Africa, from being the shooter. And I think the court should also be mindful of the pretrial photographic lineup, in which, first of all, not all the people in the lineup were Somali. Ganamo was not asked to pick out the shooter. He was just asked to pick out the photograph of somebody who stood out. And while he did pick out Mr. Alwan's photograph, he said he wanted to see more proof. The point being, tying it back to Strickland, the question before this court is not if it's possible that the jury would come to the same result, but if there's a reasonable probability that the result of the proceeding would have been different. And the linchpin, Your Honor, in the state's case is Lamont Gross. Even everything you just gave me regarding what Ganamo said pretrial is not enough to say beyond all reasonable probability that the jury would not have come to a different result if they did not believe Lamont Gross. Lamont Gross unequivocally said that Alwan confessed to him. Lamont Gross was the only witness to give the explanation as to why there would be differences between Ganamo's pretrial statements and his later saying, no, Alwan was not the person who shot me. And also critically, Gross was the only one who introduced this highly prejudicial and inflammatory evidence about Alwan supposedly saying he's a shooter for the Crips. None of that would have been part of the case. And so in assessing the reasonable probability then that the result of proceeding had been different, what was not presented that should have been presented? What evidence does this court have now before that the jury did not have? And this goes directly, Your Honor, to the statement that the prosecutor asked the jury in her closing argument. Why would Lamont Gross lie? Why would he lie if it was not true? Well, the court now has the answer to that question. He would lie because, number one, he had a pending federal charge charging him with Hobbs Act robbery, charging him with a 924C count that carried a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years in prison. He was also subject to the law that the only way he could get out from it if the federal prosecutor filed a motion for substantial assistance. That substantial assistance he had to render in the prosecution of Mr. Awan. And all of that evidence, that mechanism, that motive to lie was never presented to the jury.
How do you respond to the state's argument, though, that the jury knew that that the LG was in jail? Apparently he testified in an orange jail outfit. They knew that he had some criminal issues. And they knew his attorney was watching his testimony at the time it was given, and that all of this information was relayed to the jury, and they knew about his own legal issues, and they knew that he could possibly be giving information to help himself. Admittedly, there could have been a better effort to cross-examine him, but it's a matter of degree. But that this was sufficient information to go to the jury to make an assessment of LG's credibility, and that in combination with the other evidence was sufficient to support the verdict in the case. I'm going to ask the marshal to add another minute, because it was a minute before we realized what was happening.
My apologies. I should I resume?
Yes. Did you hear my question?
I think we were talking about wasn't enough that the jury knew he was in custody because he appeared in orange.
Right, and that fact, along with the other facts, was sufficient to support the verdict here. I guess that's the question. That seems to be what the state is arguing.
Yeah, and it just wasn't, because there's such a vast difference between what the jury heard and what they should have heard. Appearing in orange is one thing. Knowing that someone has multiple felony convictions is something completely different, including crimes of robbery and possession of a firearm. In addition, just appearing in orange doesn't tell the jury that somebody is facing a federal criminal charge that carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 25 years in prison. Telling the jury that, well, I told my lawyer about Al Juan's admission and he's here in court, doesn't let the jury know that LG is subject to this mandatory minimum, and the only way he can get out from under it is if he substantially assists in Al Juan's prosecution. There's that mechanism to liberty that the jury never heard about. He has to assist in the state prosecution, then the state prosecution has to let the federal prosecutor know of it, and then the federal prosecutor has to make a motion under 3518 USC section 3553E, or the federal district court doesn't have the authority to go below that 25 years. Addition.
But counsel, on that, may I ask, at this point in time, I mean, the jury was aware that he was seeking a benefit, presumably in connection with a criminal matter. And at this time, we didn't actually know what that benefit would be. I understand what the maximum or what the minimum was that he was facing, but we don't actually know what the benefit was going to be. Isn't that right?
We knew what he had to do to get it. That's the point, that he had to substantially assist in Al Juan's state prosecution. We also knew, Your Honor, that there was coordination between the state and the federal authorities in with respect to Gross cooperating in Al Juan's case. Then the court has this as one of the in our addendum to the brief. This letter or this report confirming that there was a proffer agreement. when Gross gave his information to Blooming detectives, there was a federal prosecutor in that meeting along with our Gross's defense attorney. None of that was brought out. And I've cited in my brief a number of cases where you have a key witness and the jury doesn't hear about the motive that they have to lie and how they stand to benefit, whether it's getting a reward for money or whether it's getting a reward for liberty, that's prejudicial under Strickland.
Is it enough though that, I mean, it was brought before the jury that he's getting some benefit. Isn't your argument he's getting a really big benefit, bigger than the jury is being advised?
Your Honor, it's completely different because some benefit is just so amorphous. What does that mean? It doesn't tell anything to the jury about what he has to do. He hopes to get some benefit, does not tell the jury that he has to substantially assist in Alwan's prosecution. It doesn't do that. It also doesn't tell them that that has to then be communicated from the state authority. Remember, the prosecutor in this case said, well, you know, you're not going to get anything from us. You're not looking for anything from us. But he was. He was. Because there had to be that communication. Because the only prosecution he was assisting in is the Alwan prosecution. But yet the benefit was going to be conferred federally. So just some benefit is just so different than the mechanism of what he had to do to get it. And also the risk of 25 years in prison if he doesn't deliver. So in a nutshell, because Gross was the key witness, he was the linchpin for the government's case, everything that the post-conviction court found in terms of the multiple errors of trial counsel, there's a reasonable probability that they would have led the jury to not believe Gross. Had the jury not believed Gross, the other evidence in the case is insufficient for conviction, and therefore there's a reasonable probability that the result of the proceeding would have been different. I ask the court to reverse, grant the petition, and remand for a new trial.
Thank you. The respondent may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests that you affirm the district court's conclusion denying post-conviction relief because Mr. Alwan has been unable to establish prejudice. I'm glad that Mr. Goetz brought up the standard that applies to whether there is a prejudice showing or not. The words that the United States Supreme Court has used to describe that showing are very telling. Although by no means insurmountable, it's highly demanding, Kimmelman versus Morrison. The essence of an ineffective assistance of claim is that counsel's unprofessional errors so upset that adversarial balance between defense and prosecution that the trial was rendered unfair and the verdict rendered suspect. Even if a defendant shows that particular errors of counsel were unreasonable, therefore the defendant must show that they actually had an adverse effect on the defense, as stated in Strickland. The question is not whether a court can be certain counsel's performance had no effect on the outcome, or whether it is a reasonable doubt might have been established if counsel had acted differently. Instead, Strickland asks whether or not it is reasonably likely the result would have been different. The likelihood of a different result must be substantial, not just conceivable. Here, the district court correctly determined that the likelihood of a different result was not established. It is true that there were problems with the cross-examination. I believe Judge Hooten, you clarified it, stating that it was a matter of some cross-examination. It didn't go to the extent that perhaps in hindsight, individuals wish it would have gone. But that is simply not enough to establish prejudice.
Well, what about the argument, though? And I'm going to start my questioning where Mr. Goetz left off. What about the argument that this LG was the linchpin witness in this case, and this was so important to the conviction in this case that it had to diminish the ability of the defendant to get a fair trial?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with the idea that LG was the linchpin. Without LG's testimony that explained why the victim in this case recanted on the stand, you still have the identification of appellant as being at the scene and fleeing the scene immediately after the shooting by an uninterested third party. You have that from DK, who was a residence inn employee who testified to observing the defendant at the scene, to seeing him run toward a back staircase, immediately after being alerted to the shooting, and you have him identifying the photograph. There's also other descriptions that place appellant at the scene. You have individuals IL, NH, and HM remember seeing him at the party. They're a little hesitant that it's not exactly the best testimony, but they also are linked to appellant. One of the individuals states that she's not really sure if he was there or not, but then on cross-examination, she admits, oh, she did have several jail calls with him. They spoke for 450 minutes. So when she said she thought she'd only spoken to him once during the trial, it shows that there had actually been 110 calls. And so this is a case where there's not just one individual placing appellant at the scene. There's not just one individual placing appellant in that room. Additionally, the initial statements that came from RG match the defendant. The description about the tooth, the description about Illege, which is his nickname, which he says has something to mean about a tooth. Also, when I believe counsel mentioned that RG asked for more proof when looking at the photo lineup, he asked for a photo of the individual smiling because of the tooth, because of the chipped tooth here. That's significant. He's not talking about, I need more pictures and I'm not really sure who this is. He wanted more a visible disfiguration that he could have seen from a smiling photograph. Additionally, the lineup in this case was never challenged below.
Counsel, may I just ask on that? And I'm going to be candid in that I didn't read all of the testimony in the case yet. Who testified to that? That he wanted to see the smile because he wanted to see the chipped tooth.
I'll look in my brief quickly because I believe I cite to that page.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. If it's in there, in your brief, go ahead.
On page 5 of my brief, it's footnote 8. I have, at the time he identified appellant in the photo lineup, RG said he wanted additional proof and asked if police had a picture of appellant smiling. I cite to that as transcript pages 354 to 60 and 444.
Okay. I mean, did he say because he had a chipped tooth? I'm wondering whether someone's, like, I saw that part, but the rest of it as to why he wanted to see him smiling. Did he testify to that or did someone testify to that?
I don't believe that he specifically testified because of the tooth, but that was in a conversation with the detective where he speaks about the fact that something was off with his tooth. So RG did make statements
about the tooth. Okay, so you're inferring that the reason he wanted smiling is because of the tooth, not that there was testimony about that.
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize if I wasn't clear about that.
Okay.
Ms. Lawan?
Yes.
Go ahead if you want to complete something to Judge Smith. I have a different question.
Oh, no, I think if I inferred that incorrectly, I apologize. Based on his statement that Illege is the one who shot him and he knew defendant as Illege as having something to do with a tooth and made a comment earlier, I think in his initial description about a tooth, that's where I drew that inference. If it's incorrect from the record, I apologize. Sorry, Judge Hallbrooks.
I wanted to go back to the cross-examination of RG because, you know, setting aside the extent of it, I think one of the primary findings here that support the ineffective assistance is the attorney's failure to do a complete and thorough investigation pretrial. I mean, he didn't have more to use in his cross, is my reading of this record, because he had not done the work he should have before trial to uncover this information. So that to me is, you know, is quite different than whether the cross was good or not good or could have been better. I think he had nothing to use.
I understand that, Your Honor. And I think that definitely goes to the first prong. That goes to the incompetence. That's why I'm not standing here before you defending the competence of the attorney's actions in this instance. And that's why the state's argument hinges on whether or not it would have been prejudicial. If he would have put forth more information, there was a discussion early in the case, I believe the prosecutor made a motion to limit any reference to any of her witnesses' criminal histories and mentioned the Jones factors and how it might be more probative than prejudicial. And so Mr. Muhammad was on alert of this, but he did not do that research and he didn't do that investigation. We're not challenging that. But even if he had, the state agrees with the district court that here it would not have made a difference. The jury was aware that there were also federal considerations. I direct you to the trial transcript on pages, on page 394 to 395, this is the redirect examination where Miss Juanita Freeman is asking a couple follow-up questions about whether he took an oath to tell the truth, if he's told the truth, if he's, and you're hopeful for a benefit. Yes, ma'am. Is that a good word to use? Hopeful. Yes, ma'am. But you've gotten no promises. None at all. Absolutely not. None from any other prosecutors. No, ma'am. State or federal, neither one. So the jury, he mentions federal. Again, we don't get into the specifics of that. I'm not trying to say that the jury was told that he faced a mandatory minimum. Of course, they weren't aware of that. But how much they would have been informed of that and how much that would have damaged the credibility of Mr. LG even further is unclear. And I don't think that it meets that standard where it actually had an adverse effect. It's a highly demanding standard. It's not an insurmountable standard. But here, looking at it, they have to show that the defendant in this case would have received an acquittal, that the jury, it would have been substantially likely that this would not have resulted in a guilty verdict, despite surveillance photographs placing appellant at the scene, despite an uninterested third party placing him at the scene, stating that he let him back into the building at 4:40 a.m., saw him leave at 5:29 and let him back in, and then saw him flee the scene immediately after the shooting. Additionally, there were the other individuals who placed him at the scene, and their testimony, as the state stated and argued in its closing, their testimony, they seem to have a little bit of memory loss. And that is part of why LG's testimony was relied upon and challenged so much. The jury heard that he wasn't credible because he was providing an information to them about the fact that appellant basically had talked to witnesses. But the jury could infer that even if they didn't believe LG. They could read that, read between the lines, looking at the credibility challenges that the prosecutor made on cross-examination. When she asks HM, you haven't had any contact with the defendants at all, and she says, maybe once. And then she pulls jail records and says, actually, 110 phone calls. Is that correct? So there were other aspects here that establish appellant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, even without LG's testimony and without a further cross-examination of LG. Unless there are further,
I was just saying thank you for your response.
Yes, it was a long one, sorry. Unless there are further questions, the clock keeps pausing on me, so I can't tell how many minutes are left, but unless there are further questions, the state would respectfully rest on its brief and ask that you affirm the district court.
Any other questions? All right, Mr. Getz, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a case where we realize the Strickland standard is high, but nonetheless, this is a case, one of those few cases where the adversarial process broke down. We're not talking about Monday morning quarterbacking here. This is a case where the cross-examination of the key witness against Mr. Alwan was constitutionally deficient. So it does meet the high standard. So I think the state makes a little light of the seriousness of the errors and also the importance of Gross's testimony. The rest of the evidence is simply not enough to establish beyond a reasonable doubt the issue of identification. And that's the only issue that ultimately the jury had to decide. Was Alwan the shooter or not? Had that been proven beyond a reasonable doubt or not? Being at the scene before the incident and fleeing it after does not make Alwan the shooter. The record shows that five other people were fleeing through the same exit doors right at the same time or near the same time Alwan was. So it absolutely does not make him a shooter. There were a large number of people at the party, many of whom fled. Also, I would just note in response to Judge Holbrook's question, it is important that the investigation here was so faulty because all of this, most of the evidence here that we're talking about was readily available from the public records. And the jury never heard about it because defense counsel never even looked. And a vague reference to a prosecutor or federal authorities in the context of him being hopeful for something is just too vague and amorphous compared to what counsel should have been presenting, was that there was a concrete and well-defined mechanism that had certain standards that Mr. Gross knew he had to meet in the Alwan prosecution. It's not an amorphous hope, it's delivering substantial assistance, helping the government convict Alwan. That's what he had to do. And also the state notes, well, there are all these other witnesses and they were witness problems. Well, the absence of evidence is not evidence. It's certainly not evidence of identification. And there's one thing about, well, you know, there may have been some questions about if Alwan contacted witnesses, you know, there's these phone calls, but it's something completely different to hear Lamont Gross tell the jury that Alwan sent family members to intimidate the key witness against him, the victim, who was going to recant his statement. That's light and day difference. But the credibility of the witness who delivered that evidence, LG, Lamont Gross, was never challenged. A proper investigation would have yielded a bounty of evidence that would have severely undermined his credibility. His credibility.
You know, can I ask you though? I mean, if we in looking at the record here, even if we eliminated LG's testimony, would there have been enough evidence in this record to support the conviction, assuming the jury accepted the original versions of the victim and these witnesses? I mean, the jury can pick, right, between the versions, which one they want to pick.
They can. The previous statements were admitted as substantive evidence, but I would say no, Your Honor. There was not enough evidence to convict because you don't have identification.
Well, the one question, and it's probably circumstantial evidence, but we do have the hotel employee saying he came in to the party and then he left and then he came back, which is consistent with the original version of the victim that she asked this person to leave and then this person came back. So based on that, wouldn't that be sufficient for the jury to believe the original testimony of the victim as well as these other witnesses as to placing this defendant at the scene?
Your Honor, I think could a jury possibly convict on that evidence? They could possibly convict. However, I think the court should be mindful, and I don't have a case site, but at the standard of review, when you have a conviction that depends upon circumstantial evidence, if the result of that evidence could also lead to a verdict of not guilty, then the evidence as a matter of law is not sufficient to sustain that verdict. So that's, I think, exactly what you have here. So at the end of the day, there's not enough evidence as a matter of law to sustain this verdict without LG's testimony.
All right, well, thank you. And counsel, you made excellent oral arguments this morning. We will take the matter in advisement and get a decision out within the next 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.